Hello and welcome to Hacks and Flacks with me, Petri Hoskin. Hacks and Flacks is the only series where you'll get the inside scoop on how journalist hacks and the flacks of government and business work behind the scenes to decide which stories you'll be reading with your morning coffee, and perhaps more importantly, how they keep certain headlines off the front pages. What happens if a public figure is a subject of a salacious story? When does a scandal make or break a career? And how do you really know what is or isn't fake news? All these subjects and a whole lot more will be explored by me and a regular panel of hacks and flacks, ready to spill the beans and tell us how the sausages get made. Flacks like former government advisors Giles Kenningham.
Hello.
And Andrew McDougall.
Hello.
Plus hacks like Mick Booker.
Hello.
So now all the gang's here, let's delve into the world of hacks and flacks.
And he insists he showed up for this meeting wearing like a Christmas tie with like Santa on it. And I'm like...
I want to be taken seriously.
Yeah, you're going to take this off. And he goes, it's my brand. Fuck you, it's your brand. Complete
Any
clown.
MP I've come across, you said, my brand is guaranteed 100% a wanker.
Hello, it's lovely to be back with another series of Hacks and Flacks. Although we live in ever-changing times, you'll be pleased to know that there are some constants in life, as Giles Kenningham and Andrew McDougall are here with me again. Hello.
Hello, Petri.
Hello.
Nice to see you both. Looking a bit older.
Oh, thanks.
But wiser.
Not any wiser.
More weathered.
More weathered.
Let's go.
Well, over the next few weeks, we'll be joined by some exciting guests, and we start that trend today by welcoming Alistair Massa to the show. You were also a government flack.
I was.
In
once
your
upon
day.
A time, that's right.
In your day.
That's right.
Well, what better way to start a new series than have a dig around into some of the more uncomfortable parts of the life of a political advisor? Let's start at the beginning. I'm fascinated to know, and I'll come to you first, Andrew, if I can. As a little boy, they're dreaming of when you were a grown up, you thought, I want to be a political advisor.
No.
No.
Au contraire.
So how did it happen?
Yeah, look, serendipity. My line to everyone is I've never been qualified for any job I've ever had. And it's true. And in this case, you know, I certainly got interested in politics. My dad was in local politics. It was kind of a topic of conversation around the dinner table. But I went to school and did a degree in physiology. I was going to go to med school, but through a twist of fate, ended up stumbling into freelance writing and started writing about politics because a friend of mine that had gone to journalism school needed a right of center voice for his free rag that he was putting together and didn't know anybody else on the right side of the political spectrum. I was the only conservative he knew. So I started writing there. And then the government changed hands in Canada. And because the government that won had campaigned on a pledge to ban lobbying for 5 years after you went into government, nobody wanted to go into government because they didn't want to face a 5-year ban because it was a tiny minority government. And so they started casting about for people who knew people. And the person I was dating at the time, her father figured I was a little underemployed to be dating his daughter and passed my CV in into government. And I got hired to work in the kind of the equivalent of the research office here. And I started writing speeches for backbench MPs, some cabinet ministers. And then one day I got a call to write one for the prime minister. It was kind of a holiday greeting that his speechwriters didn't want to waste their time doing. So they thought, let's give it to this kid to do it. And did that well enough that I caught the eye of the prime minister's deputy chief of staff. And then I went into the private sector. Again, future father-in-law thinking I was a little underemployed, misemployed to be dating his daughter. I went to work for a consultancy. And then I got the call back to go in to do press. And I said, I've never done press before. Is that a problem? Like, thinking it's the prime minister's office. I probably need to have something on my CV. And they said, no, that's not a problem. You get the politics. We'll teach you that stuff. Come in. And that led to 5 years of advising prime ministers.
Wow.
Well, a prime minister, sorry.
That is quite the accidental journey, isn't it?
Yeah, look, I look, and any of these kids, and like these fetuses that roll up to like political office, convinced that they know how the world should work. You're like, you're fucking 18. You don't know anything. So I was 30 when I got my start, which is still young in the like in the game of life. But unless you've failed and paid taxes and struggled, what do you have to contribute to politics? And I hate it when these little robots come out with such certainty. That's why you get the Liz Trusses of the world, where people are like, well, I've read this in a textbook and it must be true. And I'm going to go into the real world and explode spectacularly. No, do that explosion on your own in your own time. That's what your 20s are for, right?
It's getting worse and worse, the political class. You're getting people who go straight from university into politics.
Well, that's just what I was going to say to you, Giles. There are people now who set off in their career wanting to be exactly what you became. And that is their dream. That is their aim.
Yeah.
Is that ruining it?
Well, I definitely think it's ruining how good the advice is, which is getting put in front of politicians. I mean, you've got some of these people who potentially are advising shadow cabinet ministers who've never worked in the private sector in any form whatsoever, who then may be in a government as a special advisor. The breadth and variety of where people are coming from, I think, is narrowing.
How did you end up where you finally ended up? Because again, like Andrew, you became very senior in your
life. Yeah, I had probably more the perception of more of a logical path. So I'd been a journalist, I worked at ITV News, and then I'd come into contact with the Tories and the press operations. So I was kind of bored in my job.
Poacher turned gamekeeper.
I enjoyed being at the centre of a news agenda.
Turned flack.
Enjoyed being at the centre of a news agenda. So from that perspective, it was illogical, but it was, you know, people do tread that path to go over.
Alistair Massa, I'm giving you your full name
because
we know these guys. What was your route into it?
Yeah, again, probably more by way of accident than design. I was studying international relations in London. I was sort of finishing up, started looking at the job market, thought I'd either join the army. Turns out I had asthma and wasn't allowed to do that.
You weren't flat-footed then?
Wasn't flat-footed, right, just okay. Bad lungs. Thought also about joining the civil service, but the powers...
Why?
Because for the very reason I wanted to be working in the heart of government, I thought civil service would be a good option, especially if it was kind of MOD or FCO. But the powers that be decided I wasn't civil service material for some reason. And the kind of third obvious option was getting into Parliament kind of on the researcher side. So I was sort of throwing out CVs left, right and centre, changing Lib Dem for Labour for Conservative in my application letters shamelessly. But yeah, managed to get a job working in a pool research service in Parliament supporting Conservative MPs. And yeah, fortunately working on the foreign affairs and defence desks. This was when the Conservatives, around 2008, when the Conservatives were still in opposition, but things were looking promising ahead of the 2010 election. So yeah, found myself as a sort of 3-4-year-old into meetings with senior Conservative politicians working on issues like Afghanistan, Iraq at the time, which, you know, was absolutely fascinating.
I want to move on, if I can, to some more salacious stuff of, you know, when you were all three of you were rookies, right? And there would have been a time where either you massively stuffed up, maybe you tried to hide it, or you had to have a difficult conversation as a young SPAD or advisor of some sort. Alistair, I'm going to come to you first, because you were advisor to both chief whips.
Yeah, well, to the leader of the House of Lords and then the government chief whip in the Commons. But a lot of the Lords' work was also around whipping, but House of Lords.
Well, we know it's around
whipping.
That sounds
salacious.
I'd say fewer sticks, more carrots for the House of Lords.
So when was there a time when you perhaps gave the wrong advice? Or was that never happened?
Probably never happened.
Probably never.
Yeah, it's a very steep learning curve, these jobs, and you start off feeling, you know, very much out of your depth, and slowly but surely you kind of find a rhythm. And this is all taking place, you know, against the backdrop of a very fast-moving political environment where you haven't got a huge amount of time to be deliberating decisions that have to be taken.
Giles, I mean, again, you're going to say that you've never given ever the wrong piece of advice or ever had to kick something under the table, but has there been a moment where you literally went, oh, that was close?
Well, I've got lots of examples. There's been moments where I've been lost for words. You know, I think I was far too polite at the time. So, you know, I remember calling up an MP during the whole expenses scandal. I said, the Telegraph are going to turn you over tomorrow because you claim for a dog bowl on expenses. And he goes, I'm going to fucking strangle that dog when I go. As far as I'm concerned, it wasn't the dog's fault. And, you know, I remember having a similar conversation with another sort of shadow minister. And she had claimed for dog food. And she's like, but the dogs are my babies. And it was just like, get a fucking grip here. Do you know what I mean?
Just imagine yourself reading that on the front page if you're not you and thinking what you would think about somebody who's
dumb enough to say
that.
I think there were times when, you know, you just like, I felt like I was too polite. Go, look, you need to straight away apologise. But also in these situations, it's about, with MPs, it was like, the national story is going to turn you over, but you've then got to think about your local press, because the next thing which happens is you're going to get deselected and turfed out, and that's your living going in there. So actually, to answer your question, yeah, I mean, I'm sure there were times where I could have given better advice, times when I think I should have been more blunt with people. I do think, as a nation, being very British, we're not straight talking. And there needs to be a lot more of it. Not in the way the Australians are, perhaps the Americans is just like, call out the bullshit and say, look, this is, you know, just deal with that. You've got to put the emotion to one side. Mm-hmm. We've got to get this done and have a lot more respect. And I've worked with some brilliant Australians and, you know, I think they really bring that to the table.
Yeah, because I mean, I think everybody in the public's perception thinks we're all Malcolm Tuckers running around saying, fuck this, fuck that. And there is a bit of that. But as I said, often it's uncomfortable. You know, I remember one time a cabinet minister was going to get the sack and they'd been summoned to the prime minister's office. And these are deeply uncomfortable moments. And the second he walked in and saw me sitting in the anteroom waiting for him, he's like, ooh, this isn't going to be good, is it?
With your executioner's hood on.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you're going to be here and you know, you're like, yeah, it's time to think about what we're going to say about this. And look, I just happen to have had some thoughts about what you're going to say about this. And here they are. And does this feel right to you? Like, I'm not elected. Nobody put me in this. You know, the prime minister believes in me. That's why I'm in the job. But you're the one that has a mandate from people and is part of the cabinet. And here I am telling you what you're going to tell the press about this mistake you've made.
Did you ever feel, I'm going to say particularly you, Andrew, but by the way that you got in to the position that you got into, that at times you were just making shit up. You were just blagging it.
Well, yeah. I mean, the very first day I had that job, my boss came to me and said, I need you to brief a story about our BBC and the money it's wasting. I'm like, yeah, I can do that. I'm like, wait a second.
Google BBC.
How do I do that? And so I just, you know, asked him, well, did he have any particular targets in mind for journalists? And go, oh, yeah. Bob Fife. He hates Mother Corps. Do it. I'm like, okay, I guess I can get his contact information. I'm like, hello, Mr. Fife, this is Andrew McDougall calling from the Prime Minister's office. And he's like, what do you want? I was like, I got a bad story about the CBC. Oh, I'm all ears. And then you're like, okay, this does happen. And yeah, you just have to feel your way in. And my first boss in politics was great. So he was a club promoter, DJ.
Wow.
And kind of blagged his way into the job. And he's like, I'll give you the same advice I got on my first day. He goes, for the first 6 months you're in this job, you're a danger to yourself and others, so shut up. And you're in the room, you listen. You don't talk. And when somebody tells you to do something, you go do it. And I was like, okay, great. And then, yeah, you just kind of feel your way. And it's really, you do have to be a sponge to kind of see how this stuff works. And most of the time, you just find out that everybody involved is a human being. And journalists, they're like, they hate each other as much as they hate the government, you know? And so you get to use that to your advantage. And the tendency when you come into a job, and certainly I came in and there'd been a team around the prime minister, some of them for kind of 7-8 years through the long years of opposition. And then here's me who knows nothing about anything coming in. And you're like, I get to contribute to this too. And you have to lean into that, to your point, because, you know, especially in politics where you're taking incoming fire all the time, the tendency is just to say, fuck everybody, fuck the world. They don't understand us, right? And it takes courage to kind of go, well, maybe they have a point.
Yeah.
And this is why. And you know, you have to go back, look at Liz Truss. Like, I guarantee you there was no one in that bunker that was like, you know what, Liz? I think we might be doing this wrong.
Or did a difficult conversation, you know, didn't happen until it was too late.
No.
You have that difficult conversation at the start.
And you're not earning your money as an advisor unless you're willing to go to Liz Truss and go, no, we're going to get creamed if we do this. Like, we are going to have our ass handed to us and we'll be out of here in 44 days if we try this stuff, right? And like, who wants to be the skunk at the garden party? But, you know, whether in the private sector with our clients, you know, we could think of one. We had a celebrity that was caught doing something stupid during COVID. And they're like, I can't believe people are picking on me. Well, I can't believe people couldn't go to their mother's funerals and you were having a party.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to get your ass kicked. And you deserve to have your ass kicked. So act like you deserve to have your ass kicked and be sorry about it. Like, shut up. Stop telling me how you've been wronged.
Alistair, how do you have that conversation as a relatively young man when you went in with people who are that much older, that much more experienced, and who fundamentally are your boss? How do you say to them, you're doing the wrong thing here, this is what you need to do, and how are you taken seriously?
I think you learn pretty quickly you have to navigate the individual. You know, once you work out what makes them tick, how they're likely to react.
Manipulate.
You manipulate yourself. You sort of contort yourself into a position where you're, you know, you find the way where you're best able to get through to them. But, you know, politics is an arena where, you know, there are big egos. Everyone's in a hurry. Everyone wants kind of the limelight. And it means that, you know, some of the politicians you interact with, are asking you to do stuff and will say stuff that, you know, most people in the street would think is bonkers. And I can think of one example where an MP who was a minister in the department was late to leaving for an international trip and then called someone up who was a researcher in his office and said, I'm running late. through my own fault. I've got the chief executive of BA on my contact sheet. Can you call him up and get him to hold the plane? Yeah, to which as a sort of 20-something-year-old researcher, you have to turn around and say, with the greatest of respect, that's mental.
Yeah, no.
That's not the real world you're living in. I'm not going to be able to get through to him in a heartbeat. He's not going to be able to stop the plane. What planet do you live on? And yeah, but you have to dress that up as sympathetically as you can to someone who's shouting at you in a rush, you know?
Yeah.
Or you play back the headline, MP holds up plane holiday vacationers because he was late. Okay. Yeah. Do you want to read that?
Do you really want to see that?
No, I don't.
One which really sits in the memory was, so we used to send people undercover to events, so say a UKIP event or a Labour event, to try and catch opposition politicians saying stuff which had gone off message, off brand with their party. And we'd sent two researchers off to the UKIP Christmas party. And I got this panicked phone call at 7:30 going, shit. I'm like, what's happened? Have you been found out? That? No. So we got there. And they're like, you know that guy who was a temp who spilled on reception? And I was like, yeah, at CCHQ. He was there at the UKIP party. I was like, oh, fuck. It's basically a UKIP infiltrator has been on reception. But the reason why I was like, oh, fuck, was because he was often there, like, when we go away to party conference. So we had a guy who was a UKIP sympathizer. He was on reception at CCHQ, who had access to the office when no one was there. So anyway.
And that is how Brexit happened.
And I remember seeing this
data
guy.
Data breach.
I remember seeing this guy and thinking, he's about 40 years old. I just couldn't quite place why he was doing the job he was doing. It just didn't
40-year-old temp.
It just didn't really seem to work. No, but anyway, so then I Googled this guy's name and he'd written all these fucking articles for like the Express, like pro-Brexit. So then I'm like, oh my God, like, you know, I mean, the house is going to fall down. So then I phoned my immediate boss on it and was just like, oh shit, you know, do we out him? Do we put him out there? Sort of preempt it. What should we do?
Use him.
Well, no.
Feed bad information.
Well, no. Do we just out him, rinse it out, get ahead of this? Anyway, as it transpired, we decided to sit on it and do nothing. And it transpired this guy genuinely had been a temp and didn't abuse his position. Or if he did, he never leaked the information out. But you just kind of think, there go I for the grace of God. Like,
thank God.
That was in 2014. So that was just before the election 2015, you know, when all these UKIP defectors. So it was at height peak UKIP paranoia. You know, like there are Reds in the beds, there are UKIPers in the beds, they're under the, you know, they're in the fridge, where are they? Kind of thing.
And I was just like, smoking a brandy.
Oh, you know, like, I cannot believe that, you know, you think of UKIP, because it's classic UKIP, they're so disorganized. Didn't even like realize, oh, the guy, I mean, like, thankful the guy is very professional and didn't, but it's like, literally, you're sitting on a gold mine. How many times have we tried to get a work experience person into UKIP to be by the photocopy machine to get all their trade secrets out? And this guy was just sort of total, yeah, serendipity to end up there. So that was like, oh, shit, man.
I didn't know. Oh, you had that story. Wasn't that cabinet minister that had body odor issues? Like, just, yeah. They're not all serious, difficult conversations.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a difficult conversation.
Thankfully, this was a difficult conversation I didn't have to have. But we had reports of a Conservative MP who, yeah, there'd been some complaints about body odor issues. So this came into the Whip's office and we're sort of all dancing around trying to work out how to have this very sensitive, personal, embarrassing conversation. And we're all trying to literally work out the best way of approaching it. And then the Deputy Chief Whip at the time was Anne Milton, who's a sort of route one communicator, is how I describe her, just said, right, I'll do it. And just sat this person down and said, you stink. You're a grown up. You know where to buy deodorant. You know how to put it on. Off you go.
Did we ever establish whether they stopped stinking afterwards? Did they get their house in order?
I'm not sure we received any. Not sure we received any subsequent complaints. So maybe
anymore.
But it was a shower. It's not that difficult.
But it was just one of those things where, you know, we couldn't work out the best way of having the conversation, and Anne was just like, "There's no good way of having it. Just sit them down." And
we had an MP that his thing was wearing these gaudy kind of joke ties, and that was his brand and identity. And you know, we're on a foreign trip. I can't remember if it was India or Thailand, one place like that. So he was pulled into this bilateral meeting because he had a constituency that had a lot of South Asians in it. So it would be good for him to be seen to be in the meeting between the prime minister and the prime minister. And he insists he showed up for this meeting wearing like a Christmas tie with like Santa on it. And I'm like,
I want to be taken seriously.
Yeah. You're going to take this off. And he goes, it's my brand. Fuck you. It's your brand. Here's my tie. You're wearing this. And he's like, and he walks away. And ended up wearing the tie, and he was probably hopefully thankful because he didn't look like a complete
any
clown.
MP I've come across, you said my brand is guaranteed 100% a wanker.
Oh yeah, no.
Like, without doubt, like literally no level of self awareness whatsoever. I mean, it reminds me of like the other thing which used to make me laugh. I don't know if you had this, is when, because civil service is, you know, very British in its approach. They're not always used to really sort of blunt, straight talking. Ministers. And I remember there was a civil servant who'd fucked up, and this minister said to the sort of, I think the perm sec in the department, and you know, the sort of big wigs, like, because I take the Maoist view on this now, and you see him going like, what's he going to say?
Come again?
He goes, execute one, educate 1,000. Right, see you later. You can see that just like,
oh, there, like Dominic Raab, yeah, is that you?
It was said sort of tongue in cheek.
No,
but things, there needed to be more, like, okay, maybe not to that extreme, but you know, people not saying what they think, what they mean, beating around the bush. It's a very British thing. It's like, just, yeah, get
we
to
need
the
more
point.
You stink. And another conversation with, you know, there's another cabinet minister like to wear pinstripes on TV, and they just, depending on the pinstripe, doesn't quite look good on TV. It's better if you have a plain dark suit with like a white shirt, and like, but this is the world you live in now. Like if you look like to the joke tie, if you look kind of foolish, that's what will happen. You'll get distracted.
I remember the challenge of sort of explaining difficult concepts to people as part of the bill process in the Lords and the Commons. You sort of sit down with the leader or chief and sort of with the bill team and sort of talk through the issues and what's likely to be a sticking point and so on. And we had, I think it was the Crime and Courts Bill during my time, and we had the kind of Home Office and MOJ team in, and we had the subject of revenge porn came up, which was kind of quite novel at that point. And Jonathan Hill, who was a sort of man in his early 50s, sort of sat at the end of the table and just said, what on earth is revenge porn? And the officials in the room, of course, like all go silent, and it falls upon you to sort of explain what revenge porn is. And the guy's face just dropped. He said, why on earth would anyone want to do that? I said, well, this is why we're legislating, Jonathan, because, you know.
Because the kids do these kind of crazy things these days. Eh?
But yeah, just so many instances like that where you have to explain something to people and they're just, yeah, there's clearly no.
Well, that's where it is good to have young people in the room, huh?
Yeah. Especially in the era of TikTok. Eh?
I was running a radio station out in Germany, so I was the boss, and I got messages about my assistant who was going out and doing bits of reporting. I had to ask her to shave her beard off. She would just stand there and stroke her sort of like beard under her chin. And she's a lovely Scottish lady. And I had to ask her if she would. She was like, in a deep Scottish accent, which I won't try and do. She said, but my husband loves it. That was the most awkward that I've ever had to go.
And on that note.
Would you, Andrew, ever work back in government again?
God, no. No way. No, I always tell people, best job I've ever had, except for the one I have now, of course. But it's one I don't want to do again, because it does take, especially in this environment where nothing ever shuts off and there's just so much chatter and noise, it's impossible to do that job and feel sane. You know, I was in government for 7 years, in the Prime Minister's office for 5. I can tell you at the end of that, I felt flat. You know, it was just, there's nothing more to get. That's why I left. You know, we'd been caught in a story that was drip, drip, drip scandal. And I was the only one in the room going, we have to do this differently. We can't do that. If we do that, the Prime Minister could get his head kicked in. I don't want to see him get his head kicked in. Oh, you're just saying what the media wants to say. Well, I'm like, that's my job. That's the perspective I bring to this conversation, is that it won't work. We will get kicked again. And then it was when you noticed that there's nobody, we lost a chief of staff because of the issue. And I was like, that was my ally in the office. And if I'm not going to be listened to anymore and I'm just going to get my head kicked in around the morning table, then maybe I should do something else and move to another country and start a podcast.
Run away and do a podcast.
And here we are.
You got booted out, didn't you?
Well, thank you for puncturing through my carefully crafted statement.
Your speech to immigration, so you got passport for him.
I'm a citizen here, despite all the harm you've caused this country with your Brexit referendum campaign, Giles. Since we're throwing daggers at each other. Well, this is difficult conversations, right?
This is now just orcs. Hashtag
orcs.
Hashtag orcs. What would you advise some 18-year-old who's thinking, oh, it's the spad life for me, what would your advice be to them? Don't do it?
No, I do, but get that mix of experience in the private sector as well before you go in. I think, you know, if you can understand how the world works outside of Westminster, you're going to be a lot better at advising you.
Yeah, but they don't want to hear that. They want to go straight in. They want to get into politics.
Well, I would
they
say to them, you'll be more successful by doing that because you'll understand about how to build coalitions. You'll understand about vested interests, stakeholders. You know, the fact that we are in a world where people more than ever engage on multiple platforms, that you can do both. You know, you have time, but your worldview is going to be really, really limited. I mean, it's like, you know, somebody wants to be a journalist, you'd be like, go and learn your art and your trade in local radio, on local papers, because nothing else. If you go in at the national level straight away, you'll fuck up.
That's
and you'll
always
get fired.
My advice.
Well, you'll get fired, yeah. And you won't be a way back. Yeah. So go and make your mistakes and learn in a place where it's more forgiving or where you've got time to actually, you know, develop your skill base. You don't have that time.
It's like talk show hosts that's very young people going, I want to do what you do. Yeah. And you said, well, you've got to have lived a bit.
And how much of what you do, how much what you do will come from your instinct, your instinct's based on experience as well.
All of it.
So it's all coming
95%
through.
95%.
You probably can't even say why you've done that, but it'll be based on your experience, which then hones your skills in a certain way.
As ever, look for where the market's short right now. If you look at politics or business or media here, it's short on wisdom, right? So we don't need more ideologues that are certain about everything. They need people that have that emotional IQ, that have failed more than they've succeeded, to come in and apply that wisdom. So go get that wisdom. And then when you come into the market, and look, if you're a Tory sympathizer, the Tory's going to be out of power for 10 years. Okay, you don't need to be in a rush. Go get that skill set, to Giles' point.
I always say, don't do a journalism degree. Go and do a degree in something else and then do journalism.
But I'd also say, it's the same. You should ask them the same question you ask MPs. You know, why do you want to get into politics and public service? What injustice do you want to correct? What issue do you want to solve? Like, are you actually here because you want to make people's lives better? Or are you here because, you know, for politicians, you want the red box and the ministerial car, and for advisors, you want the kudos? You know, we need more people that actually want to get into public service for all the right reasons. So I think that should be the first litmus
test. Would you go back into it?
Yeah, 100%.
You would?
Yeah, I think so. It's a kind of weirdly intoxicating environment. I think I'm still recovering from the last stint, I think. But
how long have you been out?
Since the referendum, so shortly afterwards. But look, it's one of those few opportunities you get in life where you can genuinely see, you know, the work you're doing having an impact. And I think the great thing about spadding is, in a government machine where often everything takes a lot of time, process can be quite laborious, you can expedite things. You know, you call your colleague in a corresponding department to unblock something, to set up a concession on a piece of legislation. Yeah, half an hour later, it's been signed off and it's done. So actually, you can see the impact of your work. And so in that respect, it's really quite satisfying.
Did any of you, just briefly, ever want to become a politician through working with them?
No.
No.
One word answer.
No.
Yeah, no. People ask me that all the time. And I think I would do it. But in this system, like, what's the incentive to do it? And now that I have young kids, I'm like, okay, well, I'll have to do it when I'm older. And who knows what it'll look like then. But it is, to what Al said, it is that point of things are broken right now. Mm. And we need more smart people in there doing stuff. And I salute everybody that goes to do it for those right reasons. You know, Boris Johnson was kind of the peak, this is that it was all about the position in the red box and then not actually about doing the work. Yeah. And these jobs will grind you to the bone if it's about anything other than what you want to get done in public life.
Yeah. If it's all about your ego, then it's the wrong thing.
Guys, thank you. That brings us to the end of the first episode in the new series of Hacks and Flats. It's great to be back, and thanks for listening. And please don't forget to rate and review us on the podcast app. Andrew McDougall, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Giles Kenningham.
It's not been a pleasure, no?
Well, we're supposed to slate each other. We slate each other.
How can we get the pleasure?
No, he gets the pleasure.
Why?
But
I passed 20 pounds under the table.
Yeah. Yeah. Alistair, thank you very much for being your first time on a podcast.
Yeah, debut.
Marvellous.
Yeah.
So do rate us and review on the podcast. It helps us get noticed and to be able to give you the kind of insights that you've heard today. We'll be back with more of the same next week. Until then, goodbye. Hacks and Flacks is presented by me, Petri Hoskin, produced by Amanda Redman, and brought to you by Trafalgar Strategy. If you want to get in touch with your take on the current news climate, you can do that by emailing us at hackflackpod
podcast@gmail.com. And don't forget to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time on Hacks and Flacks.